How much alcohol is it safe to consume?
What interventions are best at preventing falls in older adults?
What's the best way to determine if you really have high blood pressure?
And does everybody benefit from statins?
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed Double T, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. This will be posted on April 20th, 2018. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a medical journalist at Johns Hopkins.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, and also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine here.
Rick, I'd like to turn right to The Lancet. This issue of alcohol consumption and what's really safe, and I would also add parenthetically, is there really any benefit to the consumption of alcohol? This gigantic study took a look at almost 600,000 current drinkers, included 40,000 deaths, 40,000 cardiovascular disease events in this average or the median of 5.6 years of follow-up. They took a look at, wow, how much of this stuff are you actually drinking? And I do have to say that the one thing I would ask The Lancet to do in the future is include our customs with regard to what constitutes a standard drink along with theirs so that we would be able to understand it a little bit better. Basically, their conclusion is that 100 grams of alcohol per week is the threshold for the lowest risk of all-cause mortality. And for all of us, including me, who really are not familiar with what's 100 grams, it turns out that here in the United States, a standard drink is 14 grams of alcohol. So that would be a beer, a glass of wine, or a typical cocktail or whatever. So we have 14. In the UK and all those places, their standard is actually 10, so smaller, significantly smaller than ours. So this amounts to less than a drink a day for most people in order to make sure that you're not increasing your risk for all-cause mortality or cardiovascular disease death.
We don't think about grams, but it's equivalent to about 5.5 standard glasses of wine or pints of beer per week. The reason why they address this, and they did this by looking at 83 different studies, is because there are different recommendations across the globe. For example, in the United States, we'd say guys should be drinking 1 or 2 drinks per day on average, and women only 1 drink per day. In Italy, Portugal, and Spain, they recommend 50% more than we recommend in the U.S., and in the United Kingdom, they recommend 50% less.
Right, and I've actually talked with a cardiologist here at Johns Hopkins about this, and he says, well, are you going to choose the red wine? That's, of course, an ongoing controversy. And then we also have that domestic issue going on right now, which is the NIH and taking funding from the alcohol industry in order to address this question a priori in a more prospective way.
This is an independent analysis of 83 different prospective studies, so the funding, it really wasn't an issue. And the other issue is, it doesn't appear to be related to what type of alcohol you're drinking, whether it's red or white wine, whether it's beer or other type of cocktails. It really does have to do with the total amount of alcohol rather than the type.
Well, I think one thing that's noteworthy about this, of course, that we talk about a lot, moderation is key. And if you're not somebody who already drinks alcohol, it's probably not a great idea to take it on for its purported health benefits.
I agree, Elizabeth. In fact, when they look at the different types of death, there was a linear increase for any type of alcohol for incidence of stroke and heart disease and other types of heart failure. What it did do was it lowered the risk of myocardial infarction or heart attacks. So if you don't drink alcohol and you do start, you increase these other risks. So the suggestion is if you don't drink, don't start to do it. But if you do drink, limit it to 1 per day.
Since we're talking about heart disease, then let's turn to the Journal of the American Medical Association. Once again, ongoing issue. What about lipid lowering and what do we know about that? This is yours, of course.
This topic, who best benefits from statins, is an ongoing discussion. What these authors did was they said, okay, it's clear for people that have already had cardiovascular events or at very high risk that there is some benefit from statins. Is there a difference between low intensity versus high intensity statin use in terms of reducing overall mortality? And does it depend upon what your baseline cholesterol measurement is, specifically your LDL cholesterol? And so after looking at over 136,000 patients in 34 trials, what they determined was that people received more benefit from more intensive rather than less intensive statin therapy, but it was limited to those whose baseline LDL cholesterol was over 100. Now, in fairness, they're comparing studies that were done 20 years ago when we first started treating people with very high cholesterols and we had limited availability of other cardiovascular medications. And now we have much more effective therapy. And the newer trials look at the lower LDL cholesterol at baseline. So it may have nothing to do with the statin. It may have to do with the fact that, gosh, we have different patients we're studying now. Their risk is overall lower. The addition of statin to these patients isn't particularly helpful.
Okay, so given all of that then, what are you doing with your patients right now with regard to going on a statin?
So if somebody already has cardiovascular disease, they've had a heart attack or had bypass surgery, then I think the evidence is pretty good they should be on a statin. If it's for primary prevention and their LDL cholesterol is already 100 and they aren't at high risk, they don't have hypertension or diabetes, or they're not cigarette smokers, I don't tend to use a statin.
And I wanted to muddy the waters a little bit further by saying, how do you think these newer cholesterol-lowering agents are going to play into this?
Some of the studies they looked at were those that involved the newer agents. And again, if someone's LDL cholesterol is very high and a statin doesn't bring it down, these newer agents add benefit.
This is a moving target. I'm guessing we're going to hear more about it. Let's turn from here to my fave. I love these things. You know, I always love it when patients are able to take control of their own world. In this really big study, a cohort that included from Spain almost 64,000 adults from 2004 through 2014, they took a look at blood pressures that were measured in the clinic and 24-hour ambulatory blood pressures. And they followed these folks for a median follow-up of almost 5 years. During that time, they had almost 4,000 patients die from any cause, about 1,300 of them from cardiovascular causes. And they were able to really parse out different categories of people who may have been called hypertensive or normotensive, having high blood pressure or not. There were those who had high blood pressure when they were in the clinic, but whose ambulatory blood pressures did not show it. There were those who had it, interestingly, when they had the ambulatory pressure taken, but they didn't show it in the clinic. There were those who just didn't have it at all. Basically, what they saw was that high systolic blood pressures, no surprise here, were associated with greater mortality. They also found, and this is for me the big aha moment, or not the aha moment, but confirmatory given a lot of data we've seen in the past, that 24-hour ambulatory blood pressure is way more predictive than anything that's measured in the clinic. And I think argues very strongly for people being able to measure their own blood pressures once they have a cuff or a device that's been validated into their electronic record.
Elizabeth, I couldn't agree with you more. I think this provides more ammunition to the fact that ambulatory blood pressure provides more prognostic information and also tells if the treatment is more effective over a 24-hour period than just what we see in the doctor's office. The mask hypertension, that is someone who walks in and the blood pressure looks fine in clinic, but it's high outside, they had 3 times the mortality than people that had a normal blood pressure. You'd never find that in clinic if you used a single measurement. It's a very robust database.
I think that any way that we can engage people in their own health is really much better and more ultimately valuable than any way that gets imposed from the outside. So I think just the mechanism, just asking people to do this on their own is going to result in lots of positive change.
And these ambulatory blood pressure units, they're now less than a pound, they're portable, and they're affordable as well.
And we're seeing more with apps, and I think that we're going to see some really good ones coming over the transom fairly soon. Let's turn to your last one. That's in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Very important public health problem. Falls in the elderly with that hardline trajectory, really, to death.
Falls are the most common cause of injury-related morbidity and mortality among older adults. About a third of community-dwelling adults aged 65 years or older report falling. That's 29 million falls in the United States alone. What the United States Preventative Services Task Force reviewed the data to say, what are the best interventions at preventing falls? They focused on exercise, individualized intervention, and the use of vitamin D. And what they determined was that the best intervention was exercise. I would have thought that the individualized intervention would have been most effective. That's where a health professional would go in, sometimes do a home assessment, do individual nutrition counseling, balance training. But overall, that did not reduce the number of individuals who had a fall, nor did it reduce the serious falls. The only thing that did that was exercise.
What type of exercise?
They didn't quantitate it because there were 62 different studies, of which, by the way, 21 involved exercise. But we've talked before about Tai Chi, simple walking, or can be exercise conducted in an exercise facility. But it is regular exercise. Now, the thing I didn't mention was, does vitamin D actually prevent falls? Well, now we have 7 different studies, and it appears that vitamin D really doesn't prevent falls. It doesn't prevent injurious falls. It doesn't prevent fractures in these individuals either.
Very good. Of course, I'm going to talk about the ambulatory blood pressure this week on the blog. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices.